perfect so far is Roy Halladay. He's an out away.
The 1-2 pitch. Hit toward third. Castro has it. Spins. Fires. A perfect game! Roy Halladay has thrown the second perfect game in Philadelphia Phillies history.
10 years ago today, pitcher Roy Halladay joined an elite club, throwing the 20th perfect game in Major League history. But behind the excellence that Halladay strove for every time he took the mound was a man who privately struggled with depression, anxiety, and addiction. ESPN investigative reporter John Barr spent months conducting exclusive interviews with Halladay's family, friends, and coaches as part of tonight's E60 special. Today, we take a look at the hidden side of a Hall of Fame athlete and the gap between public perception and private struggles. I'm Ina Kimes. It's Friday, May 29th. This is ESPN Daily, presented by Marathon. John, Roy Halladay is undoubtedly one of the greatest pitchers of his era. He led baseball in wins, complete games, and shutouts from 2002 through 2011. He's enshrined in Cooperstown. He's the second player to ever throw a no-hitter in the playoffs. But your piece is titled Imperfect. Why is that?
That title actually came from Brandy Halladay, Roy's wife. It came from her speech that she delivered at the Hall of Fame induction last summer.
I think that Roy would want everyone to know that people are not perfect. We are all imperfect and flawed in one way or another. We all struggle. But with hard work, humility, and dedication, imperfect people can still have perfect moments.
And Mike Farrell, one of the producers of this project, really seized upon that as a potential theme for the story. You know, this is a story about a guy who engaged in a relentless pursuit of perfection, and there was a cost associated with that.
You spent months working on this, interviewing people close to Roy, trying to find out who he was as a person. What did you learn?
Well, we learned that there was a side of him that we just didn't see. The image he projected to the public was that of a stoic workhorse.
I'm playing to win a World Series. If it takes 320 innings and I can throw that many, I'm going to throw it.
He came across as somebody who was just laser focused, the consummate professional, the consummate teammate, but away from the field, and we know this largely through an extensive and far-reaching interview we did with Brandy Halladay, his widow. Away from the field, even early in his career, Roy struggled with anxiety.
Everybody sees him as this very strong, dominant person, but he was terrified. He, for whatever reason, didn't feel that he had the luxury of making mistakes. He was tormented.
It wasn't just anxiety that was rooted in his fear of failure as a baseball player. He suffered from deep-rooted social anxiety. Later in life, he was treated for attention deficit disorder and depression. And we now know that he also struggled with addiction in the final years of his life and in the final few years of his career.
So in reporting this piece, you went all the way back to the beginning of Roy's career. How did it start for him?
Not well.
He's got all the tools, but right now he has no clue whatsoever.
A lot of people don't remember this part of the Roy Halladay story. In the year 2000, he wasn't just bad. He was historically bad. He posted a 10.64 ERA that year. And that remains the highest ERA for any starting pitcher with at least 50 innings. So he had the worst ERA ever for a regular starter in Major League Baseball. Frankly, the Blue Jays didn't know what to do with the guy. You know, he was a first-round pick, and he was awful. And they basically sent him down to low A ball to figure it out. And the late Mel Queen, the coach for that team, really deconstructed his pitching motion. He was way too over the top. They lowered his arm slot to more like 2 o'clock, if you can picture that. It added devastating movement to his fastball. It moved away from right-handed hitters and down. And that was his bread and butter pitch for years. But more importantly, he got his head right. So what happens? The guy comes back, turns it around. In 2002, he had an absolute breakout year. and then proceeded to go on this incredible run where for the next decade, he was dominant.
Roy Halladay with a complete game shutout.
Over that stretch, he had 30 more complete games than the next closest guy, who happens to be CC Sabathia, by the way. That's kind of the baseball equivalent of lapping the field. So that just doesn't happen. You don't go from being that historically bad to having a Hall of Fame career, and yet Roy Halladay did.
In talking with his family and friends and teammates about his career arc, you asked them not only about how he came back and, you know, became the legendary pitcher that he was, but also how he handled it mentally. What did you learn?
Yeah, Brandy Halladay shared with us that Roy had tremendous anxiety before every start.
He would take sleeping pills the nights before he pitched because he couldn't sleep. The anxiety of pitching the next day was so overwhelming for him. He needed the help.
Millions of Americans take medications like Ambien to get a decent night's rest. Well, he did it in large part because he just was a bundle of nerves on the eve of his starts. He would throw up before every start. I mean, you think about Roy Halladay, who projected just this aura of confidence. It's kind of hard to get your mind around the idea that he would throw up before every start. But, and I mentioned earlier the social anxiety that he dealt with. When he left the Blue Jays and went to Philadelphia, a team that was coming off back-to-back World Series appearances, he was seen as the guy who could get the Phillies back to the World Series. And that brought with it a tremendous amount of pressure. Now, he responded on the field. His 2010 season was unbelievable. A perfect game, a postseason no-hitter.
It's surreal. I mean, it really is. I just wanted to pitch in the postseason, you know, to be able to go out and have a game like that. You know, it's a dream come true.
He did all these things on the field, but away from the field, Brandy says, you know, he was emotionally really struggling.
John Halladay injured his back in the 2011 postseason, and the injury stayed with him. In 2012, one of his teammates introduced him to a Florida doctor who sold him opioids for cash. How did that affect him?
When he came home after that 2012 season, according to Brandy, he was severely ill. He was in bed for 2 or 3 weeks. He had flu-like symptoms, and she confronted him.
He thought he could just stop, that he only needed it for when he was pitching. And he realized when he came home, his body was dependent on these medications just to function.
That was the first time she became aware of the fact that he was taking this pain medication in order to pitch. And she really wants to deliver the message to folks that it wasn't because he was looking to get high. It was because he was looking to do his job. He was making $20 million a year. He felt tremendous pressure to be the ace of the staff and help get the team back to the postseason and a World Series berth. And frankly, he was willing to sacrifice his body in order to do that.
Did his teammates notice a change?
In 2013, they did. One of the teammates we spoke with was Kyle Kendrick, and Kyle and Roy were very close. Teammates jokingly called Kendrick Little Roy because of his attachment to Halladay. And it was in that 2013 season that Kendrick told us that at one point he looked over at Halladay and tried to talk to him.
You know, in his locker, I was right next to him and tried to talk to him, and he felt like he wasn't there.
He was really disturbed by his behavior. So he and a teammate went to somebody with the team, and the team then decided, according to former pitching coach Rich Doobie, to have a player who Roy respects tremendously approach Roy and talk to him about his drug use. We don't know what that player said. We're not naming that player, but we do know now that the Phillies were on notice that Roy's behavior was troubling to some of his teammates. We also know that after that 2013 season, while he was still an active member of the Phillies, that's when he went into inpatient drug treatment for the first time.
John, that's where you began your written piece with Roy Halladay checking himself into a Palm Beach inpatient treatment center. What happened?
Well, Roy and Brandy were not in a good place. Roy in particular realized once again that his body had become chemically dependent on these medications just to function. When he got home back to Florida after that 2013 season, he knew he needed help. And Brandy reached out to a guy by the name of Steve Trax, who was the financial advisor to both Kendrick and Roy. Steve was also very much a friend of the Halladays. He'd known them since 2000. And Brandy called Steve Trax at his office in Virginia, distraught, and said he needs help. And he knows it and I know it. And Trax flew down that same day. And that same day, they drove across Florida and got Roy into an inpatient drug treatment facility. You know, Brandy didn't tell the boys what was going on. They had two young boys, dropped them off at a friend's house and dropped her husband off at a rehab facility. And then the next morning, she had to go to a baseball tournament for her son and act like nothing was wrong. It was really tough on her, and it was tough on Roy. And she said that he didn't stay long enough. Somebody snuck a cell phone into the facility, and he was mortified that he'd be outed as seeking treatment. And so he left early, and in her estimation, before he was adequately treated.
Halladay retired that December. How did he handle the transition from being a big leaguer to being a quote-unquote normal citizen?
He was, in Brandy's words, lost. So much of his identity from the time he was a young boy was wrapped up in the idea of being a big league pitcher. Baseball was all he knew. That routine was all he knew. And when that was gone, there was a huge void. So he was struggling with pain, and he was struggling with trying to find a purpose in life, and that led to depression. He just didn't know how to self-identify outside of being a baseball player. And it was later that he realized he needed more help again with his ongoing abuse of prescription pain medication. In early 2015, he checked himself into a treatment facility and stayed nearly 3 months. And it was after that, Brandy says, that he sought treatment from a psychiatrist for depression, for anxiety, for attention deficit disorder, and really began to turn his life around. But he struggled, Mina. He struggled mightily.
All right, after the break, let's talk about Halladay's life after baseball and the circumstances surrounding his death. We're presented by Marathon. Now, more than ever, we have to look out for each other and count on each other. And Marathon wants you to know that you can count on them for high-quality, top-tier gas. While we are aware travel might not be top of mind, there might be times where you have to hop in the car to run an errand. Maybe you have to drop off groceries and supplies to your family. Maybe you've become an amazing baker and want to drop off a few dozen cookies on your best friend's porch. Or maybe you just want to drive around to all of your friends' homes simply to wave from a safe distance. But before you head out, remember to fuel up at Marathon. Marathon gasolines are formulated with STP additives. They keep your vehicle running at peak performance by optimizing fuel economy, removing those ugly deposit buildups, and reducing emissions. Remember, wherever you need to go, the people at Marathon are behind you all the way. Marathon, fueling the American spirit. John, Roy Halladay retired in 2013. As you mentioned, he struggled a bit with the transition away from baseball. How did he spend his time?
Well, he really floundered for a while, as I mentioned, but he did eventually pour himself into coaching his kids' teams. He has two boys, Braden and Ryan. And also, he reignited his passion for flying. He owned two planes. He owned two single-propeller Cessnas. And starting in 2016, started posting images about a new plane that he desperately wanted to buy called the Icon A5. And Brandy, in her mind, although she was concerned about where he was mentally, decided that it was a good thing, a positive thing for Roy to have something that he could pour himself into.
I was worried. It was difficult for me. But at that point, I knew that I had to concede somewhere too. And if he could do it the right way, I would support him.
You said reignited. How did he get into flying in the first place?
Well, it started with his dad. His dad taught him how to fly before he taught him how to play baseball. His dad has nearly 25,000 hours as a corporate pilot. And he talked about bringing Roy up into the plane when Roy was as young as 2 years old.
I gave him instruction and I started a logbook for him. And it started at about 2 years old. I would let him hold the controls and, you know, he could fly the airplane and keep it level.
You know, the two would go out into the fields and do model airplanes. And it was his dad who essentially taught him to fly. You know, Roy got his pilot's license in 2013 while he was still technically a member of the Phillies. But that was really rooted in the upbringing with his dad.
What kind of pilot was he as an adult once he got back into it?
According to his dad, he had really good stick and rudder controls. He was cautious, but there were also concerns that his father expressed to him.
My concern was after he got the airplane, he started talking about how sporty it was and what a sports car it was. And I said, now be careful with this thing, you know, and be careful with it.
There's sort of this stage you get to as a pilot where you have just enough hours to be confident, but not enough hours to be safe. It's kind of the equivalent of you figure out how to drive a car, and so maybe, you know, you race the yellow light or you go a little faster than you should go. And Roy's father expressed concerns later to federal investigators that perhaps his son was pushing the envelope too much.
Take me through what happened on November 7th, 2017.
Well, Roy dropped both of his boys off at school that morning and was back home by 10:30, and he was trying to figure out what to do with the rest of his day. The youngest Halliday son, Ryan, had a band concert at his school later that day, and Brandy asked Roy if she wanted to ride with him. She had a few errands to run before the concert, and he said, no, I'm going to take the Icon A5. By that point, he had a two-seat light sport aircraft, an amphibious aircraft called the Icon A5, and it was parked behind his house. He said, I'm going to take the Icon A5 back to the airport. Brooksville Regional Airport was about 25 miles north of where the Hallidays lived in Odessa. So Brandy leaves, Roy gets in the plane, and he texted her and he said, you know, I should have just gone with you, another wasted day. And she replied, you know, no, I wasn't mad. I just thought maybe we could go together. I love you. And that would be the last time they communicated with one another. Brandy went to the band concert, and Roy didn't fly north. He flew west toward the Gulf of Mexico. He climbed to an altitude of about 1,900 feet. Once he got over the Gulf, he turned back south and started to track along the shoreline. Over the final 3 minutes of his flight, Mina, he engaged in what you can only describe as unsafe behavior for a pilot. He flew low over the water and over houses and over boats. Some estimates are that he flew as low as 5 feet over the water. I talked to one fisherman who talked about how Roy flew right over his boat and just buzzed his boat. And in the last 3 minutes, he engaged in three maneuvers, which essentially were steep climbs followed by dives. And in the final climb, he got to an altitude of about 500 feet, according to a witness, before turning back toward the Gulf and then started to go into a rapid descent. That same fisherman I referenced said it appeared as if the nose was coming up at the end, but Roy's plane impacted the water at a 45-degree angle. The depth of the water was only about 4 or 5 feet, and he was killed.
How did his wife learn what had happened?
She was at the band concert, and she was texting him about where she was sitting so that he could join her. And she received a text from a friend saying, please tell me you're not flying today. There was a small plane crash behind my house. And She didn't think anything of it at the time, but she was concerned, but she wasn't overly concerned at that point. But then she wasn't hearing from Roy.
I kept sending notes, please tell me where you are. And now I'm worried, because now I'm not getting a response. I called the airport and they're like, no, the plane's not here. So I called my brother and I said, can you please go to the house and tell me if the icon's in the lake? And he called me back and he said, Brandy, there's a sheriff here who needs to talk to you. And he was crying. I knew.
John, I think many people learned for the first time that Roy Halladay had struggles off the field at all when the toxicology report came out after the crash. What was in his system?
Well, he had a combination of drugs in his system. He had a sleep aid. He had called Zolpidem, which is more commonly known as Ambien. He had an antidepressant, fluoxetine, which is sold under the name Prozac. He had an anti-anxiety medication. He had a muscle relaxer. He had high levels of amphetamine, which, according to the medical professionals we spoke with, likely was a result of the Adderall, the attention deficit disorder drug that he was taking. We interviewed three independent forensic pathologists, and we also interviewed the medical examiner who did Roy's autopsy and toxicology report. And all four of those medical professionals are of the opinion that more likely than not, Roy was impaired on the day he crashed. I guess I should add, the National Transportation Safety Board has not come out with its final report. They came out with what they call their factual report in mid-April. The final report is where they actually list a probable cause for the crash. We're awaiting that. But if those medical professionals are correct, and we have no reason to suspect they are not, I think there's a strong likelihood that the NTSB will acknowledge the medication is playing some role in the crash. We know that there was no mechanical failure listed in the factual report. There was nothing wrong with the plane. We also know that Roy went through extensive safety training in the Icon A5 and that the plane itself had a number of safety features associated with it, not the least of which is a parachute that he could have deployed that would have slowed the fall of the aircraft as it descended toward the Gulf. This is a situation, Mina, where Roy's father, his own father, acknowledged to us that Roy didn't make the best decisions that day. He was flying in a reckless manner. According to medical professionals, he was impaired, and those two things combined contributed to his fatal crash.
Was Roy's family aware that he was still struggling around that time?
Well, according to Brandy, that's the real tragedy of this. He was in a better place. He had coached his son Braden's team. They had a magical run that spring, went undefeated, won a state championship. And, you know, Braden teased his father, well, now I'm the only Halladay with a championship ring. It was a great father-son moment. Brandy and Roy were in a better place. They were going to weekly counseling sessions. In her words, he was figuring out that being normal was okay. And that's what really makes this tragic, is that he was there. He was at that place in his life. And then this happens. And it just left a gaping hole in the lives of that family and the baseball world. I mean, the baseball world was denied one of its great guys on that day.
All right, in a moment, I want to ask you about your personal memories of covering Halladay and what your interactions with him told you about who he was. Hi, guys. Given everything that is happening in the world right now, most of us are buying things online. I saw that AT&T started doing two really helpful things for those who want to buy a new phone or device online. They are offering fast, free, non-contact delivery and curbside pickup so that online shopping is as simple and safe as possible. On top of that, they have a flexible return policy so you can shop at ease. You can visit att.com to learn how to shop online from the safety of your home 24/7. Subject to change, restrictions apply.
Halliday is one strike away, the 0-2. A bouncer, Ruiz. In time, Roy Halliday has thrown a no-hitter.
John, in many ways, this piece is sort of about the wide gap at times between the public-facing image of these superstar athletes and their private lives, sometimes what they might be struggling with. Did your perception of Roy Halliday based on his public image and what you knew before change as you worked on it?
So, Mina, my perception of Roy Halliday was rooted in a story that I've shared and my family shared many times. I live in the Philly area. I was fortunate to be covering the game that Roy threw a no-hitter in the postseason in October of 2010. And we interviewed him on the field, and it was after filing our story that I was winding my way through the bowels of Citizens Bank Park, and as I rounded a corner, I saw Halliday, who was just kind of milling about. He'd already finished all of his media interviews, and at the time, I was on the phone with my family, so I put the phone down. I went up to Halliday and I thanked him for giving us something special to watch. And then when I walked away and put the phone back up to my ear, my then 7-year-old son, Jack, he said, "Dad, was that really Roy?" And I took a look at Roy and I took a look at the phone and had a complete, I guess for lack of a better word, a fanboy moment. I blew protocol. You know, there's no cheering in the press box. You're not supposed to ask for autographs. But there's just something about the guy, that moment, that night. And I put him on the phone with my kid, and he was kind enough to talk to my son. And then my son, I thought, asked him a pretty good question. He said, "What's it like to throw a perfect game and a no-hitter in the same year?" And I thought that was a pretty damn good question from a 7-year-old kid. You know, I thanked him as he handed the phone back. And, you know, I don't know how you can't just have anything but appreciation for somebody in that moment. So that was my brush with Roy Halliday, if you will. So many professional athletes who, as you well know, you wouldn't dream of, you know, doing something like that with them. But he was approachable and he was kind and he was decent. And I can tell you that having gone through all of the reporting we went through, my perception of him is not diminished at all. I think if anything, I have a greater appreciation for what he did, given what he was dealing with away from the field. In terms of his struggles with mental health issues, in terms of his struggles with addiction, he dealt with that and he managed to carve out a Hall of Fame career. And according to his family and friends, you know, he was fighting. He was fighting up until the end. He was fighting his addiction. He was getting treatment for the mental health issues he had. And he was fighting to save his marriage, according to his wife. And I don't know how you can't have respect for somebody like that.
Thanks so much, John.
You bet.
I'm Mina Kimes, and this has been ESPN Daily. Our show is produced by Alexander Hyacinth, Mike Johns, Steve Martin, Ryan Nantel, happy birthday, Ryan, Andy Tennant, Eve Tro, Chris Tuminello, and Aaron Vail. Happy birthday to you too, Aaron. Special thanks this week to Russell Donnalo, Troy Farkas, and Eve Wolf. I'll talk to you Monday.